Today's great life is of a politician who not only fell from grace like Lucifer from heaven, but in doing so bequeathed to the English language a suffix, gate, which still means scandal and opprobrium. So I'm looking forward very much to hearing why today's guest has chosen the life he has. Historian Dominic Sandbrook has made a tremendous impact as an acute chronicler of the 1950s and 1960s in his books Never Had It So Good and White Heat. The two books he's currently working on will take his project up to 1979 and the election of Margaret Thatcher. But Dominic, let's reveal for those who haven't guessed your choice of great life.
I've chosen Richard Nixon, not merely because he's an icon of incongruity and awkwardness, and not merely because of his great achievements as president, which I think are much underrated, because what we know about Nixon tells us probably more about the human condition and about human insecurity and human frailty than almost any other figure in history. We know more about Nixon because he taped himself than we do about almost anybody else who's ever lived. And everything we know about Nixon, the loneliness, the solitude, the awkwardness, the resentment, the paranoia, I think that's something enormously sympathetic, pathos in the true sense, the story of Nixon. He's a Dickensian character, and his fall is something that should appeal to everybody.
Our expert witness may or may not take a different view. He is Professor Philip Davis of the Eccles Centre for American Studies at the British Library. Philip, in addition to being Professor of American Studies, specialising in politics, you were in Washington at the time of the Watergate scandal. What do you remember of that time?
I remember, as the thing unfolded, arguing with my flatmates over who was going to read the Washington Post first every morning. It was better than the comics, quite honestly.
Let's first look at the history of Richard Milhouse Nixon, the 37th president. Dominic, he was born in 1913 in what I think were very humble circumstances.
Extremely humble circumstances. You know, this isn't a John F. Kennedy or George W. Bush. Nixon famously said his father owned the only lemon ranch in California that didn't make any money. His father was tried to set up a service station, a grocery store. Two of his brothers died of TB. It's the story of the poor boy who everybody despises and denigrates, who sort of hauls himself up by his bootstraps. So Nixon's achievement in getting to the top of Republican Party politics was incredibly impressive, given where he'd come from.
How did he haul himself up in that way, Philip? What did he do after school?
Well, he did very well at school. That was one of the things. He went to college. He graduated second, I think, in the year. And in virtually every class from that point onwards, he graduated second or third. I don't think he ever graduated first.
Yeah, there's a great story about Nixon. 1929, I think it was, or 1930, I'm not sure which. He ran for student president at Whittier High School, and he didn't win. He was beaten. And that was something that always rankled with Nixon. That thing about always finishing second or third. You know, we know from his Oval Office conversations that he would talk about his school days. He would talk about his youth. I've been put down my whole life. People have looked down on me. They stole this election. They stole that election.
Well, he did, absolutely. And I think this does make him rather different and not entirely explained by his background, because, you know, Clinton was poorer than the Nixons. In fact, I'm not sure I'd call the Nixons poor. They got by. They got him to college and all that stuff. Reagan came from very humble backgrounds. Eisenhower came from very humble backgrounds. None of them had this automatic chip on their shoulder about it.
How did he get from wartime service in the US Navy into the House of Representatives?
He was really picked up by a group of Republican leaders and business people and invited to run for Congress. And he ran a very sharp campaign in
1946. He was a veteran with a young wife, very presentable. You know, he's regarded as handsome in those days. He's not yet the sort of jowly monster of the 1970s. And I think he was seen as a sort of clean-cut, honest, fresh face, an outsider, if you like. You know, he's a young guy, he's a husband, he's a father, all those kinds of things. And that's why people voted for him, because they projected onto him the virtues that they sort of associated with the American way of life.
At the same time, this was a man who didn't have policies. What he had was enemies. And he ran his campaigns right from the beginning, as though he was fighting against enemies.
How did he make the enemies?
I think most of them were imagined in terms of slights against himself. But also, in his early campaigns, what he seemed to realise was that the public do respond to fear at times in elections. And so in his next campaign for Senate, when he's facing Helen Gahagan Douglas, he says, you know, there'll be no name-calling in this election. He says that in a very early speech. And then he says, the pink lady, pink right down to her underwear, thereby labelling her both as a communist and as a kind of effete rich person at the same time.
Let me just speak up for poor old Dick Nixon here. She threw just as much mud at him as he threw at her. She was the person who coined the phrase tricky dicky. And ironically, her way of defending herself against Nixon's allegations she was a crypto commie was to say, no, it's Nixon who's actually soft on communism, not me. But I think there's always a little element of class prejudice in this, actually, all the way from the sort of late 40s, 50s. Democrats, and particularly a particular kind of Democrat, very well-educated, affluent, would say of Nixon, oh, he's so tawdry, he's so vulgar. Adlai Stevenson used to say of him, he doesn't even dance properly. You know, he's a dirty guy.
Rather patrician.
Exactly. Sneer. And a patrician sneer against the ugly little school SWAT character, if you like. And I think Nixon internalised that, and he started, I think, to play up to it. So he does become a little bit dirty later on, but I think it's a bit harsh to stamp
I'm
on him.
I'm not sure about a little bit dirty later on. This was the nature of his campaign from the beginning, and he continued it throughout.
You've both agreed that he was by no means always the media disaster that we remember from that sweaty and jowly jousting with Kennedy. And here's an example, a clip from a broadcast in 1952... following accusations of improprieties about political funds.
We did get something, a gift, after the election. A man down in Texas heard Pat in the radio mention the fact that our two youngsters would like to have a dog. And believe it or not, we got a message from the Union Station in Baltimore saying they had a package for us. You know what it was? It was a little Cocker Spaniel dog in a crate that he'd sent all the way from Texas. Black and white, spotted. And our little girl, Tricia, the six-year-old, named it Checker. And you know, the kids, like all kids, love the dog. And I just want to say this right now, that regardless of what they say about it, we're going to keep him.
This is BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris, and you're listening to Great Lives, where my guest, the modern historian Dominic Sandbrook, has chosen the life of Richard Nixon, our expert witness, is Philip Davis. That's a brilliant little bit of getting himself out of difficulty, isn't it?
Yes.
You can't attack a dog.
It's the first major use of television in the political arena, and it's brilliant politics.
There are other aspects of this. You know, the Checker speech wasn't about the dog. He made it about the dog. That's the clever bit. That's the media manipulation that Nixon was good at early on and remained good at until he goes down the tubes. But it was about whether he'd had a slosh fund paid for by multimillionaires or millionaires and whether they had received political favours.
So let's move him, Philip, from successfully defending himself with the story of the dog to becoming president. How did he make that leap?
Well, it was a long trek, actually, and one that he assiduously pursued. And in 60, he runs for election and loses by a whisker to Jack Kennedy. And then he runs in 62 for governor of California. And again, he loses and is very bitter at this point and makes a rather embarrassing press
conference. You won't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
You won't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore. But he didn't keep his promise.
Let's just look at that election that he didn't, by a whisker, quite win. Do you think that if Nixon hadn't sweated in that encounter with Kennedy, he might have won?
It's possible. I think there were 250,000 votes in it, so it was enormously close. Vice presidents normally don't do very well in presidential elections, so Nixon actually done quite well to get it so close. Nixon's one of these men who's sort of buffeted by fortune all through his life. He'd been in hospital just before the first debate. He'd lost a bit of weight. His suit was too big for him. And ironically, the man who partly owes his political career to TV makes the elementary mistake of refusing to wear the right makeup for the lights. And of course, we know now that all presidential debates, all TV debates, always favour the challenger. The less well-known man is the one who often gains from them. So Nixon probably would be better advised not to have done the debates at all. And of course, you know, history would be... It would be Nixon, ironically, who would now be the man who had pass the civil rights legislation. Nixon would be the champion of civil rights because he was, in many ways, more for it than Kennedy had been in the late 50s. But he didn't get elected, so now he's, you know, dirty old Dick.
But he quickly, Dominic, turns into, at least at the early stages, what we see as a progressive president. Do you think he had progressive ideas for domestic and foreign policy goals?
I think he did, actually. I think, certainly in foreign policy, his goals were to end American involvement in the Vietnam War, which he did within 4 years, which is precisely what his Democratic opponents had said they would do. And in terms of domestic policy, you know, you look at things like the environmental legislation that he passed or pioneering welfare reforms. These are things that you don't normally associate with Republicans. Nixon was, to modernise, quite a left-wing Republican. He's a pragmatist. He's obsessed with doing things and winning popularity.
One couples this apparently rather open, tolerant of new ideas sort of person, Philip, with an increasingly paranoid personality.
That is true. He chooses the Ehrlichmans, the Haldemans, perhaps most notoriously Charles Colson, the man who said he'd walk over his grandmother for Richard Nixon. And then basically, yes, stays behind their wall. Even when they try to open him up more to the world, he doesn't want it. But it was Ehrlichman's task force that actually comes up with the proposals, not with Nixon. Many of them are from Democrats like Senator Kennedy. And what Nixon said is, all right, give me this if you've got to, but make it as slow as possible and as little as possible.
Well, I think Phil's being very unfair here. But to be fair, he's in a big tradition, the tradition of American liberal historians who always say, oh, this isn't really Nixon, it's everybody around him. Of course, they're happy to give Roosevelt credit for everything that Roosevelt's aides and that Congress does under Roosevelt, but not Nixon because he's Nixon, so you can't give him any credit at all.
On the other hand, though, let's get into this. If we're talking about, for instance, legislation, Nixon sent fewer legislative requests to Congress in his first year than Kennedy, Johnson or Carter. Most of that legislation was in there already. It wasn't coming from him.
But he could have vetoed it. Presidents do veto things.
He could have vetoed it. You're right, he didn't veto the big things, but he did specifically ask them to be slow, you know, on school desegregation. Do what we have to do and no more. He's the only president to send in lawyers to argue against what
he said. He's the president who desegregates more schools than any other in
America.
He's American
the president in whose term it happened, but it's done by lawyers who were put in place.
We always
give
precedent to credit for things that happened in there. But going back to your point about his personality.
Yeah, the paranoia.
I think what's really interesting about Nixon is here he is at the summit and he's so unhappy. He is a very joyless, miserable man. He always feels the next challenge is just around the corner, that he's never done enough. So to give you an example, in 1972, he was re-elected with, by some standards, one of the biggest landslides, the biggest landslide in American political history. Now, what does he do? Does he have a party? Does he celebrate with his wife? No, he locks himself on his own in his office, in his little hideaway upstairs. He puts on music very loud. He sits in the darkness and he makes notes on his beloved yellow legal pad about how the opposition will, the ways in which the opposition will try to discredit his victory.
Sounding like Gordon Brown.
It's very Gordon Brown-like. Exactly. There's a real parallel between Nixon and Brown, I think, in that they are men, I think, who are very good at some aspects of politics, but for whom politics is bad. He used to write himself these notes, sort of pep talks. So he wrote one note. This has been found in his old desk. He would write notes that said things like, stop recreation except purely for exercise. In other words, he thought he was taking too much time off, even though this is a man who's sort of sleeping 3 hours a night, he has 3 minutes for lunch.
Beating himself up.
Absolutely obsessive. He, for instance, outlawed the serving of soup in the White House because he once spilled it on himself and he said, never again, there can be no more soup. He insisted on seeing all the menus. He even insisted on seeing the sort of seating plans because he got it into his head that Henry Kissinger was always somehow getting put by the most attractive women in the room. And Nixon deeply resented this.
Now, here's a challenge. To sum up in just two or three sentences what the Watergate scandal was all about, how it started and where it went. See if you can rise to that challenge, Philip.
What was it about? Well, it was about a comprehensive attempt to sabotage the Democratic election campaign. One little tiny bit of it was the break-in to the Democratic headquarters, which then led to a massive abuse of power while members of the administration perjured themselves, lied. Nixon lied time and time and time again to the public. 40 members of the administration end up indicted or found guilty of various charges, and a massive corruption of democracy.
Fair, Dominic?
Not unfair, I suppose, is what I'd say. I think the key thing about Watergate, what I think about it, is it's a classic example of a scandal that has its roots in something relatively minor, and it's the cover-up that is the killer. Because, of course, the one thing that Nixon didn't do, that nobody's ever been able to discover, Nixon didn't personally order the Watergate break-in. His paranoia gave rise to a climate in which his henchmen thought, this is what the president wants us to do. But he didn't say, there's no tape where he says, get in there, bug it, all the rest of it.
So do you accept that, Philip, that he didn't do it?
There's certainly no evidence that he ordered the Watergate break-in. On the other hand, there's quite good evidence that he ordered the Daniel Ellsberg break-in, which came before that.
Oh, he did, no question. What all this comes back to, the money, the election campaign, the dirty tricks, it's all rooted in Nixon's insecurity. He was going to win by the biggest landslides in American history against a terrible Democratic candidate in George McGovern. Nixon was going to smash him all over the shop, whatever happened. But he always had this obsession that it was going to be stolen from him. So it's all rooted in this kind of very banal anxiety, this chip on his shoulder and this resentment and all the rest of it. And that's, of course, what makes him so, I suppose, sympathetic in some ways.
To what extent was what was finally uncovered when the searchlight shone on Watergate and all that went with it, to what extent was that the kind of thing that had always gone on in American presidential elections, and this was simply the first time that everyone found out about it, do you think?
Well, Phil and I probably disagree about this, but I think it had always gone on. American presidential politics, certainly in the 19th century, had been notoriously corrupt. Johnson, Nixon's immediate predecessor in 1964 and then in 1968, had been somebody who liked to throw a few punches under the belt, as it were, and there had always been money sloshing around the American political system. I would certainly agree that Nixon took it, Nixon's people anyway, took it a stage further, but this wasn't something happening in an otherwise clean political system.
Occasionally, odd people would do these things, or everybody did one or two of these things. Nixon did them all, and he did them in massive scale. He raised twice as much money as any presidential candidate had done in history before that, and spent it, and then spent more on top. Certainly the comprehensive level of sabotage and break-ins and so on that they launched is much more than any campaign has ever done before, and the total disregard of constitutional norms was much more than had ever been done before. So no, I think this was on a different level.
How does the unfolding scandal, the break-ins, the espionage, the money, all the rest, how does it develop into the final impasse which we now remember as Watergate?
Of course, the irony is that it didn't all come out until after Nixon won his great landslide. Mm. So almost as soon as he's won, the stories begin to come out. The big problem, I think, is there are far too many people who know about it. There's all the burglars. There's all the people in the administration who knew about it. And the key thing is when Nixon's White House counsel, his lawyer effectively, his sort of political lawyer, John Dean, when he goes to the prosecutors and tells his story and says, actually, it was all cooked up in the White House and the president knew about it after the fact and tried to cover it up. Then there's this huge, long battle with Nixon trying to sort of keep a lid on it, and more revelations coming out. He loses some of his key men, they resign. But then, of course, it comes out that he's, shock horror, taped himself. I mean, this is the great revelation that really dooms him. People think, what kind of nutter tapes all of his conversations in which he's planning criminal conspiracies? Well, the answer is Richard Nixon. And then the battle becomes, is he going to disclose his tapes? Now, of course, if Nixon had really been this sort of ruthless Machiavelli of legend, he would have had an enormous bonfire in the Rose Garden and burned all the tapes. What he does is he sort of desperately tries in this increasingly sort of futile and tragic way to hold on to the tapes, and eventually they all come out, and that's curtains.
The reason he kept the tapes was because he kept on thinking he could control anything within the executive branch, because he was going to just say, that's mine, you can't look at it. And the tapes were going to be a kind of masterpiece theatre of how I was a great president.
Is this the point when he realises the game is up, Dominic?
Well, there's this dreadful Shakespearean kind of last 18 months of his presidency when he's an unhealthy, sleepless, kind of miserable man, but the fates are kind of closing in around him, and he knows that he has to go.
Well, here he is on August the 8th, 1974.
I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Now, I remember that I was at Yale, and all my American friends at Yale had been telling me for months that this was really serious, and they would be able to get rid of the president. And I had said, oh, no, being British in politics, you know, it never happens in the end. The fellow squirms out somehow and everybody carries on and he ends up in the House of Lords. and I was wrong, and my American friends who had said it was coming to this were right.
Talking about your and my fellow students, for them, of course, Watergate was what caught him, but that wasn't what it was about. They were the people who thought his management of the end of the Vietnam War was what he should be found guilty for, and not just
Why?
The war in Vietnam. The rolling bombing of Cambodia, the destabilisation of Laos, the fact that in those years he lost another 21,000 American lives and getting on for a million Southeast Asian lives, four terms that were not really much better than they were at the beginning, and so certainly some of these things they felt were again, fundamentally unconstitutional. But also, of course, they were the kids who were going to go.
But, so Dominic, I've always seen Nixon as the man who got America out of Vietnam.
Yes, of course, Phillips' friends should have been thanking Nixon for ending the draft, which meant that they wouldn't have to go to the war. They could also have been thanking him for bringing all those, 500,000 American troops, or however many it was, back home. I mean, I think Nixon's got an incredibly bad rap about Vietnam, which wasn't his war. Particularly after, the experience that we've had in Iraq and Afghanistan, you realise just how difficult it is to get out of wars. It's not that easy just to sort of pack up and go home. It doesn't quite work that way.
You'd give him credit, Philip, wouldn't you, for the rapprochement with China?
Oh, yes. He was probably one of the few American politicians, because of his earlier career, who could have led a doubting American population into those kinds of links, not just with China, but actually even with Russia too. I don't know that he knew where he was going with it, but nonetheless, he opened the door. That's not a bad thing.
Yeah, you can't exaggerate the impact. Those photos of him shaking hands with Chairman Mao, or the picture of him embracing Brezhnev in the Kremlin, to Americans, yeah, those were just unimaginable scenes for Nixon, of all people, to be doing this. I mean, these were huge breakthroughs that a lot of more cautious, possibly less imaginative presidents, I think, would not have attempted.
And he also knew the power of them. Again, there was personality in here. You know, when he shook hands with Shao, he made sure that Kissinger was held back in Air Force One and couldn't come down the stairs with him, so he'd only be photographed on his own. When he was flying back from China, they parked up in Alaska for several hours, so they would land in Washington, D.C. at 9 p.m., peak viewing time, so the television could see him coming in. This was a man who, in 1968, probably made no impact, but was willing to try to stop the South Vietnamese taking part in peace talks in order to enhance his own chances in the election.
Do you think, Dominic, that when it comes to that final resignation and the speech, there is left in him any sense of pride in the things that he's done, or is it just anger, fatigue and bitterness?
I'm sure there is a little bit of pride, but I don't think you'll ever find a better example of a politician who is more disintegrated than at that moment.
Here he is on August the 9th, 1974, talking to the White House staff as he leaves following his resignation the previous day.
We think that when someone dear to us dies, we think that when we lose an election, we think that when we suffer a defeat, that all has ended. We think, as T.R. said, that the light had left his life forever. Not true. It's only a beginning, always. The greatness comes not when things go always good for you, but the greatness comes, and you're really tested, when you take some knocks, some disappointments, when sadness comes. Because only if you've been in the deepest valley, can you ever know how magnificent it is to be on the highest mountain. Always give your best. Never get discouraged. Never be petty. Always remember, others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win. unless you hate them. And then you destroy yourself.
I think that's really touching, actually. I think that what you have there is a man who has been humiliated in the eyes of the world in a way that most of us can't possibly imagine. A man who has been stripped bare of the political spin and the sort of presentation tactics and all the rest of it. I think there you have the real Nixon. There you have what drove him and what defined him.
Professor Davis.
It's an emotional speech by a humbled man. Humbled for not very long. He starts rebuilding his reputation very quickly, or trying to rebuild his reputation very quickly. But certainly he's doing his best at the time in out of a state of shock.
This is an enormous emotional crisis for Nixon. This is everything that he has worked for all those years, and it's all been sort of torn down around him, and it's his own fault.
I nearly think that that's a great and moving speech, and I nearly think that it's completely false.
Yeah, well, of course, yes. But I don't think it is false, because Nixon had barely slept at all that night. The night before was the night in which he had had this ghastly farewell with Henry Kissinger, where they had gone and looked at all the White House portraits, and Nixon had burst into tears and said, "Will you get down and pray with me, please, Henry," and all this business. So Nixon's in a dreadful state, and he's not in a state, I think, where he can think clearly and calculate how it will be received.
He says in the speech it's wrong to think that the light is going to go out in your life. Did the light go out in his life after that?
It very nearly went out. He almost died about a year later. He had phlebitis in his leg, and he deliberately allowed it to get so bad that he had, at the end, I think, an 18-inch blood clot that nearly killed him. That was almost it for Nixon. And then, of course, Nixon did what he always did. He's like his opponents would say he's like a cockroach. You can never kill him. He just thinks to himself, well, you know, this is yet another campaign. He girds himself back up. He gets back in touch with his network. And he starts rebuilding his reputation as a sage, as a wise man who writes all these books about foreign policy.
The interview with David Frost.
Exactly, which is a crucial step on that road.
And also gets his lawyers working very hard to stop any of the tapes coming out that aren't already out, to disguise what any further truth coming out.
Is it true, Philip, that when he died in 1994... 50,000 people queued up to file past his coffin?
Oh, certainly thousands did, yes.
And you know why they did that, though? They did that because he's an American everyman. Because people saw... he's not like Kennedy. People saw in Nixon themselves. He is the self-made man. He's the man from the sort of poor background. And they looked at Nixon and they thought, yeah, he reflects what I believe in. He's the American dream.
You've been listening to Great Lives, whose subject this week has been Richard Nixon, championed by Dominic Sandbrook. Our expert witness was Philip Davies. Goodbye.